Section 14H1 of the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act allows the Native regional corporations created under that act to select 2 million additional acres of land for historic sites and cemeteries. A number of federal agencies are involved in the identification and conveyance of 14H1 sites, among them the National Park Service, which has established a 14H task force at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Wendy Arendale is the project leader for the 14H Cooperative Park Studies Unit, also called the Alaska Native Historic Sites Project.
When the rules and regulations for the 14H1 section of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act were set up, the National Park Service, which has historically served as the nation's archaeologist, at least the federal government's archaeologist, was put in the position of doing the anthropological research that had to be done on the sites. And we, as a contract unit of the Park Service, have that function. Originally, in the first phase of the whole 14H part of the land claims, Native corporations were involved with identifying and nominating those sites that they potentially would like to have as part of their land holdings.
And then?
And then, well, there was a deadline, the same deadline as all the other land claim nominations, when they had to have all the sites that they wanted or potentially wanted on record. And then since then, we have been involved in actually going out to the sites, getting as much library and background information as we can before we go, going out to the site, locating local people who know something about the site, often taking them to the site so that they can talk about the site, walking around on it. Often this evokes many memories, stories, history of the area for us. We do an archaeological survey of the site, which means we walk over the site and record everything that we find there. Occasionally we will do a very small test on the site if there isn't much on the surface and we need some evidence of what's below the surface, but usually this is either done with an auger or is a very, very small square hole, less than a meter or a meter square. And we do very, very little of that sort of testing. It's only where we need more information about a site that we do that. And then we come back, we do further library research, we go through the archives, we find, gather together all the information that we can about that site, and then write a report which deals with its historic significance. We are charged, in effect, by the rules and regulations with making a statement about whether or not that site meets the criteria for significance that are set out in the rules and the regulations of the 14H1 provision. And in general, most of the sites that the corporations have nominated meet those criteria very well.
Do you ever independently nominate sites? Do you find in your exploration sites that have not been selected by the corporation?
Yes, we sometimes find those sites, but they, at least at this point in time, cannot be nominated under 14H1. However, we usually call them to the attention of the corporation so that if the corporation is developing a preservation plan for their historic or archaeological sites, they can keep a record of where that site is and manage it as a historic resource.
So your function at this point then is essentially verifying previously selected sites.
Yes, but it's a little bit larger than that too, because we do everything that we can within the very limited budget we have to feed back information into the communities. And right now we're seeking some grant support to hire a specialist whose job it will be to take the information that we gather, which generally goes into legal documents and technical reports that have to do with conveyance of the land and that sort of thing, and put it in a form which is more readily accessible to people in the rural Alaskan communities. We feel we have a tremendous obligation in this area, but almost no money is provided in our funding for this, so we're looking for all the ways we can to feed back this information to the people who are probably most interested in having it.
As it is now, people in any location who wish to obtain copies of the 14H reports and assessments have a difficult time. Only 20 to 50 copies of each document are printed and distributed, free of charge, but for person number 51, it's necessary to have the often lengthy publication Xeroxed at quite some cost. But for the National Park Service project, the high cost of fieldwork takes precedence over publishing costs, and fieldwork on 2 million acres of territory is no small task. Although that acreage may not be sufficient to encompass all regional corporation selections for historic and cemetery sites.
Will that 2 million acres encompass every site that has been nominated? I would guess not. But I think there are other ways that historic and cemetery sites can be preserved. For example, there's the National Register of Historic Places. Corporations are free to nominate sites for the register and protect them that way. There are matching grants available through the State Historic Preservation Office for projects related to the preservation of historic sites and buildings. And this includes historic preservation plans. And I might say here that I'm using the word historic in a very broad sense. It includes prehistoric and historic, archaeological, as well as the kinds of things that we think of as more recent, say, cabins and so on. But there are matching funds available through that source, and there is also expertise and help available from various people around the state who are very willing to offer their assistance in encouraging and providing expertise in terms of developing these kinds of plans. And I think that's an important aspect of historic preservation on potential native lands, because under 14H1, lands on village allotments and similar kinds of lands were not open for 14H1 nomination, and they won't receive, at least initially, under our program, the kind of consideration that sites that are nominated will receive. There won't be the kind of surveys and interviews and background research that we're doing, unless the corporations do it themselves. And obviously, some of the villages are in places that have been occupied for thousands of years. They have a particularly good geographic or subsistence location. And so I think it would be valuable if corporations can find the money and the technical skills to do preservation planning on their own. On the other hand, I have to also recognize that there are many other priorities for corporations to deal with, and this is only one of them.
Wendy Arendale, project leader of the Alaska Native Historic Sites Project of the National Park Service's 14H Cooperative Park Studies Unit. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Toby Talbot's holistic approach to health includes the relaxing effects of massage.
Massage, when it works right, is like a dance between the giver and the receiver. It's a joyous experience for both. The most important part of the massage for the giver is that the giver gets himself or herself set, centered, together before he ever touches the person who's receiving the massage. I kind of stand over the person and I kind of just go inside myself, and I put my hands around the person's aura, and then I just feel when we're in touch with each other. When you're ready, you know, the energy just starts to move. When you work on the head, you can work without any oils. And also, you want to kind of rub your hands together so your hands aren't real cold, and don't give a shock to the person who's receiving the massage. I'm going to work from the head down on the face. And I'm going to start by putting some pressure across the forehead from the center out. Often moves are done in threes. I don't know why. What we want to do here is to stimulate the circulation and to get rid of tensions. We carry a lot of tensions in our jaw areas. I'm just pinching the area around the jaw here. We carry a lot of tension around our eyes. You can even take your thumbs and go gently over the eyeballs. It's very pleasant. We carry a lot of tension too at the base of our cheekbones here. You can make teeny little circles here, just where the cheek begins to move out by the base of the nose. The ears are our antenna that allow us to pick up energy. And if you just unfold the folds of the ears, you become more alive to the energy that's around you, and you get a new awareness of your surroundings, which is always fun. You can take your fingers and put them all around the ears here. And then some people like to have their ears totally occluded so that they're kind of inside themselves. It's just very gently put your fingers in their ears and they get a chance just to go deep within themselves, only for maybe 30 seconds. Then you can check with the person who's being massaged to see if they'd like that or not. Did you like that?
I did.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We do a lot of different kinds of things in massage, and for me mostly I do nonverbal work, and then the person usually lets me know. I can usually sense in the body if it's pleasant or not pleasant, but it's usually a nonverbal experience so that the person can really get in touch with their body, what it feels like, and to feel what relaxation feels like. The relaxation aspect of massage is crucial to good health, mental, spiritual, and physical.
Toby Talbot. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. An 11-year-old girl, Doris Oring, disappeared on June 13th. She was bicycling home on Badger Road in the North Pole area south of Fairbanks. Despite an intensive search, there are few clues. According to Trooper Roger McCoy, the case is unusual in two respects.
Primarily because there was a limited amount of physical evidence. In fact, there was nearly no evidence at the scene where her bicycle was found at 9 1/4 mile Badger Road. And because of no evidence, we have very little to go on except for what the public at large gives us.
McCoy estimates that approximately 300 volunteers have been searching the Badger Road area, backyards and abandoned structures in North Pole, and nearly any place that the girl may be secreted. This is the first time, to McCoy's knowledge, that a juvenile has been abducted in Fairbanks, and possibly the entire state, and not returned within a few days.
We have to assume the worst has happened. And the type of individual that would abduct a young girl, a child, not return her, we have to believe that the possibility she is not alive any longer. This type of individual is a type that is a repeater. He will progressively become worse and will continue this type of activity if he stays in the area.
McCoy says that the person is most likely a Caucasian male, possibly of Hispanic or Italian descent, between the ages of 14 and 30, is intelligent, a loner, and a fetishist who finds sexual gratification in bondage, though not necessarily the sex act itself.
There was a man seen leaving the scene at the time she was abducted. I'm talking about within minutes.
That's your only lead, though.
That's about it.
Since traditional investigative techniques have not been promising, non-traditional means may be used.
I have considered using a psychic, and we have contacted a couple of psychics. whether they are successful or not, I am saying that we cannot lose anything by using them. We have everything to gain.
Roger McCoy of the Alaska State Troopers. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
In the garden,
in bed,
firecrackers,
and moonbeams,
hot dogs, and heartburn,
the smell of the wood fire,
the smoke in your hair,
in your clothes,
friends,
and family,
nosy, lonely neighbors,
running noses,
running away,
running out of beer,
and only Fred Meyer's is open,
always,
polyester pants,
flame on,
light that fire,
it won't ignite,
polyester when lit sticks to the skin,
ask Richard Pryor.
Sparklers in the midnight sun.
No spark.
Cherry bomb.
Pass the beer.
Pass the mustard seed.
I'm gonna be sick. The fourth time around. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.